Barbarian Tribes of Rome, the Anglo-Saxons, Anglo-Saxon art. Now, people often get the impression that the Anglo-Saxons were brutes who enjoyed war, killing, feasting, loud celebrations, and occasional domestic violence. However, archaeological evidence provides us with one more important aspect of Anglo-Saxon life. They were also very skilled artists, with skills varying from metallurgy to manuscript illumination, from jewelry crafting to ivory carving, and from making elaborate tapestries to sculpting enormous monuments to their culture. Culture's art can give us a lot of insight in what they valued, how skilled they were with a particular craft, what materials and tools they used, and how their culture changed through the centuries. Most of the artifacts found between sub-Roman Britain and Norman Britain show an affinity towards Christ and Christianity, which isn't all that strange considering we now know how it developed throughout the centuries. Illuminated manuscripts are a perfect example of this. For the uninitiated reader, an illuminated manuscript is a religious document where the text has a lot of elaborate ornamentation, such as decorated initials, page borders, and even miniature illustrations. The materials used in such practices were usually silver or gold. However, that's largely true for Western Christian tradition of illumination. The initial illuminated manuscripts combined a lot of different styles of art, namely that of Germanic, Celtic, and Italian illumination. The Stockholm Codex Aurus is a perfect example of this mixture of styles. Since its portrait is largely Italian, or rather tries to imitate Italian style, while the letters themselves are insular in nature. Insular art, it should be noted, is an art style that developed in Britain and Ireland, which is distinct from all other styles of mainland Europe. It's called insular because the term insula means island. There aren't a lot of manuscripts with elements of insular art in the 9th century Britain, but their elements can be seen in manuscripts from mainland Europe, wherever the Anglo-Saxon missionaries did their work. For example, the Ertak Abbey in Luxembourg houses the famous Ertak Gospels, which were mostly illuminated in Northumbria. By the end of the 9th century, however, the so-called Winchester style of illumination was created and heavily used. Some distinctions of this style include agated or wrinkled draperies, acanthus borders, and historiated initials. The best example of the late Winchester style of illumination is the Benedictine of St. Ethelwald, which actually drew from a few other styles such as Byzantine and Carolingian illumination. Producing goods from precious metals such as gold and silver, or even basic metals and alloys, was a practice the Anglo-Saxons actually did before Christianity. The most frequent examples of this practice are found in the 7th century, usually as round, elaborate brooches, thanks to the discovery of the ship burial at Sutton Hoo. We know that these brooches, and indeed other metalwork, were highly developed at this time. Brooches were far from the only items found and unearthed from the Anglo-Saxon period. Archaeologists also found rings, coins, belt buckles, military fittings, and other various items. From written records, we also know that the metal workers made statues, doors, shrines, and other large-scale metal pieces, but barely any of these survive to this day. The most likely reason for their disappearance is the constant Viking raids followed by the subsequent Norman invasion and other events. Unfortunately, looting was frequent during these raids, and the monasteries and churches, as the best-equipped places in England, had these items in abundance. In terms of masters of metalwork, we have a few of the artists' names available to us from written accounts. One such artist was Spierhofo, who later became a Benedictine monk, an abbot, and the bishop-elect of London. He was prominent in the mid-11th century and was renowned for his skills at goldsmithing, gold engraving, and painting. It is probably these skills that got him promoted so quickly to a high church position. Another artist of similar status was Manning of Evesham. Both artists have their lives documented and chronicled in their respective abbeys. Other artists are mentioned as well, but mostly in passing. A lot of these metalworks include scenes of animals and reeds or bushes carved onto the surface, but the Anglo-Saxons didn't just use metals to carve the scenes they wanted. More often than not, they used ivory and other types of bone for equally elaborate efforts. For example, an entire casket, most likely carved in Northumbria in the 8th century, was made of whalebone. It even had a riddle on it that hints as much. The artist actually imported a lot of these bones, especially the walrus bones, from the north. Other examples of ivory carvings include various scenes depicting Christ, either his birth, crucifixion, or different motifs from the Bible that included him. But metal and ivory wasn't enough. Anglo-Saxon stoneworkers even carved and shaped rocks, mostly to get massive outdoor crosses, but sometimes they have an elaborate relief. These crosses were often combined with pagan and Christian elements, which is one of the reasons why they were frequently destroyed or defaced during the Reformation. Many of these crosses actually survived in Ireland and can be seen today. A cross would typically be very tall and slender, with some exceptions to this rule having been found in Mercia. Elements of Celtic paganism would often be there, as well as vines and leaves. Moreover, there are some hints that these crosses were covered originally in paint, somewhat like Greek and Roman statues. The crosses themselves were popular at the time, especially when the Danish Vikings began to invade, and when they finally took control in the late 10th and 11th centuries. They began to mass-produce similar stone crosses, but they didn't have the same artistic quality of their Anglo-Saxon predecessors. Textiles were equally popular canvases for contemporary Anglo-Saxon artists. They favored embroideries and tapestries, and many such works were made in the early medieval England period. Sadly, again, few survived, but mainly because the material they were made from was reused in other works of art. Possibly the most famous example of Anglo-Saxon tapestry is the elaborate Bayeux tapestry, which depicts the Battle of Hastings. Of course, the tapestry itself was made within 20 years after the battle, but it is done in a style and manner of old Anglo-Saxon weavers. As we have established earlier, embroidery and other needlework were largely done by women. Therefore, we can safely assume that the nuns and priestesses made the Bayeux tapestry. Interestingly, some historians claim this work of art to be the first European version of a comic book because it is sequential in a storytelling nature. Finer textile works incorporated silk and precious metal threads, namely gold and silver, as well as lots of precious gems, glass beads, and pearls. More often than not, these elaborate tapestries were owned by priests or royal families. They were usually used in religious ceremonies. Now, the Anglo-Saxons also dabbled in other materials. For example, glass was very popular when it came to making luxury drinking glasses, like the claw beakers from the 6th and 7th centuries, glass beads, church windows. Sometimes they would import glass workers from Francia, also known as France, but oftentimes they would just rework old Roman glass items. Enamel was also used instead of glass. Then there's leather. Anglo-Saxon books would be bound in different types of covers. As we saw earlier, they could even be ornamented in ivory. Leather was one such material, and we have a famous example of the late 7th century to show us how skilled the craftsmen were at leather bookbinding. The stunning St. Cuthbert's Gospel is the oldest Western-bound book to remain unaltered to this day. It has incised lines, elaborate relief decoration, and even some color. Naturally, the Anglo-Saxons didn't just use leather to bind books. Their leather artwork probably also covered belts, purses, satchels, though we don't have a lot of the physical evidence of this, and the contemporary texts that talk about leather binding don't mention more than the secular uses of leather for ornamentation. We can see the Anglo-Saxon artists had a wide range of skills and a wide range of materials. Of course, their missions to the continent also brought knowledge of illuminating manuscripts, carving figures, working stone and fabrics. With that in mind, we can say that the insular art of Britain influenced a lot of early Christian art styles, even in Europe. Even certain motifs became commonplace after the Anglo-Saxon missionaries began traveling to Europe. For example, the elements of Christ's legs and feet alone being seen in the Hellmouth, St. John the Evangelist riding in the foot of a cross, Moses with horns, a depiction of the Last Judgment, Mary Magdalene at the foot of the cross, all originated in Anglo-Saxon Britain. They would become widely used in European art in the following centuries. Now, next time, which will be a little short, we'll be looking at the written works of the Anglo-Saxon period. Now, the sources for this, The Germanic People, Their Origin, Expansion, and Culture, by Owens, Attila the Hun, by Worrell, The Burgundians, by Charles River, The History of the Ostrogoths, by Burns, and The History of the Vandals, by Jacobson, as well as the history of the barbarians. So I hope you enjoyed that. And as always, don't forget to come by the website, sumahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.